America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings. Happy Friday to you. Shabbat Shalom, TGIF, whatever. Whatever it may, blessed be, whatever it may be for your appropriate perspective, religion, or whatever. It's a beautiful day here. 6 minutes here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. 6 minutes past the hour, the first hour of our program. And the first hour of our Friday program has been for going on 3.5 years now. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us answering your questions. Bernie is on the floor of the Senate right now. They're having a series of votes. And so he's going to be calling in, and when he can, he will be with us and probably hopping in and out throughout this hour, assuming that all is well and that his phone is working and all that kind of thing. He's in the cloakroom right now, and so we're waiting to hear from him. So when he calls in, we'll pop on the air, and he'll be taking your calls, assuming, well, we'll get an update from him on how everything is going in the Senate. J. Stephen Griles, the former number two official in the Interior Department. This, you know, the Republican corruption scandals are just rolling along, is going to admit to the Senate about his relationship with Jack Abramoff, the convicted lobbyist, who succeeded in getting Giles to intervene with the Interior Department on behalf of Abramoff's Indian tribal clients. That's interesting. This is the 10th person, second highest level Bush administration official to face criminal charges, this before the Justice Department today. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Hey, Bernie.
How are you, Tom?
Just great. I understand you're down on the floor of the Senate today.
We are down on the floor where there are going to be about 20 or 30 votes on the budget. So I may on occasion have to duck out, but I'll be back.
Okay, great. And what's on your agenda for the day? What are you?
Well, a lot of things, Tom. It's been a very busy week in Washington. Right now, we're working on the budget. Clearly, the issue, to my mind, but I'm afraid I'm far from a majority here in the Senate, is to figure out how you create a fairer tax system by rescinding Bush's tax breaks, and then adequately funding the needs of the middle class and working families. Yesterday, interestingly enough, we brought up what I think was for the first time in a while an effort on the floor of the House to begin rescinding some of the tax breaks for the wealthy. Our proposal was to do away with tax breaks for anybody who received in 2001. We would end the tax breaks given to people who made $1 million or more.
Mm-hmm.
Not a radical act to my mind, but a fairly radical act for
now,
the U.S. Senate.
Was this part of the amendment that you offered to help reduce property taxes?
Exactly. So what this amendment would do, very simple amendment, it would have stopped, rescinded all of the tax breaks that went to people earning $1 million a year or more. That is 0.3% of the population. And then it would have raised $44 billion over a five-year period, and that money would have gone into special education. And that is terribly important because a promise made in 1975, I believe, to school districts all over this country is that as part of the special education legislation that was passed, that the government would pick up 40% of the cost. In fact, we're picking up 17% of the cost. It means that all over America, in school districts, in my state of Vermont, but in virtually every other state, property taxes are soaring in order to make up the difference, and I think that's wrong. So the goal was to ask the wealthiest 0.3% of the population to pay a little bit more so that we can lower property taxes for all of America and have the funding for special ed and for the needs of our kids. We got 38 votes on that. We got zero Republican support. We lost the number of Democrats. But it is a start in that effort to undo some of the damage done by Bush's tax breaks.
This is interesting because, for example, Debbie Stabenow, who voted in favor of the credit card bill or the bankruptcy reform thing, which I didn't, you know, which was in my mind kind of anti-progressive, voted in favor of this amendment of yours,
right.
And yet Ron Wyden voted against it. My senator here in Oregon,
right.
Maria Cantwell voted against it. Why the Democrats who defected?
Well, we lost 10 Democrats, and you'll have to ask them. It's disappointing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I disagree with them. You know, but it gets back to a basic problem the Democratic Party has, and that is, I think, to be successful, they're going to have to make it very clear whose side are they on. Middle class is hurting. The deficit is growing. You don't continue to maintain huge tax breaks that go to a handful of families in this America, in this country, while property taxes are soaring, and while the needs of our kids for school or for middle-class families to send their kids to college or for child care or for the needs of our veterans are so desperate.
Yeah, so, I see the Senators Obama and Clinton both supported your effort.
Sure. But this is an effort. I'm going to continue this effort, and I'm going to, and I think we will gradually get more and more support. But this speaks to an issue that you and I have talked about a whole lot, and that is the power of big money over the political process. So we lost 10 Democrats, but more interestingly, we lost every single Republican. There was not one Republican who had the guts to say to the wealthiest 0.3%, gee, you should pay a little bit more so that we can help our kids, so that we can lower rapidly rising property taxes all over America. But I'm going to stay on that issue. And I think you will see, if not this year, next year, you will see some progress being made there. The other interesting thing of many that has taken place in Congress is we had Al Gore testifying before the Energy Committee, of which I'm a member, on Wednesday. And I thought Gore did, frankly, a very good job. He has become extremely knowledgeable about global warming, about not only the causes, not only the implications, but he has some strong ideas as to how Congress should move forward. And I think his message, which I agree with, and I have offered, I think, the along with Barbara Boxer of California, who's the chair of the Environmental Committee, the strongest legislation dealing with global warming, his message was a very simple one, is that this planet is facing an emergency, was his word. And we have got to be bold, we have got to be aggressive. But what interests me very much on this issue, Tom, not only is it the right thing to do, I think, in fact, at the end of the day, we can improve the quality of life of our people as we begin to deal with pollution, with greenhouse gas emissions, with coal-burning plants, and as we move our country toward more energy efficiency and to new types of sustainable energy. I think, and a lot of economists would agree with me, that while there will be economic dislocation, some people will be hurt, overall we can, in fact, net gain a whole lot of good-paying jobs as we expand solar technology, as we move toward having solar panels on people's homes, on our schools, on our office buildings. We move toward all kinds of wind energy. We do research on biomass. In Vermont, we're making some progress. We have a long way to go. Biofuels, ethanol is now exploding in terms of the amount of corn going into ethanol. We can do better than corn. We can work to move towards switchgrass, other products that are more efficient. We're just beginning to move in that direction using the tides of the ocean. I mean, a whole lot of technologies out there that at the end of the day can not only clean up our planet, but create millions of good-paying jobs. So that's an issue that we are working very hard on.
And the clean up our planet part of that is not insignificant with Mrs. Edwards' announcement yesterday of the recurrence of her cancer. One in three Americans gets cancer, and probably the major source of carcinogens in our environment, or certainly one of the major sources, is the byproducts of oil, all the various byproducts of oil and the combustion of it. And if we can move off that and onto solar power, we'll see a healthier country.
Tom, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the focus right now, obviously, is on the immediate crisis of global warming, and what that will mean for floods, what it means for droughts, what it means for the loss of farmlands, or increased hunger, loss of clean drinking water, flooding in coastal regions, and et cetera, et cetera. But you're absolutely right. It goes beyond that. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that one of the causes of a number of illnesses, including cancer, has to do with the kind of environmental degradation that we are currently seeing. So I think moving to more localism, where we're producing the food that we need in our own communities, and that speaks to saving the family farm, where we're producing more locally generated electricity, where we're beginning to deal with the outrage of just how much energy we waste in transportation, in our homes. I mean, I was just noting the other day, almost beyond belief, that Bush's people want to zero fund the weatherization program. Right now, you shake your head and you wonder where these guys are living, but there are millions of lower-income people today who are living in homes where the insulation is inadequate and so forth and so on. So we have a real opportunity to move this planet and our country forward by aggressively reversing global warming and improving environmental situation.
Great. And Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders. And he will be taking your calls right after the break, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number is the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, as we do every Friday. We have for over 3 years now our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Sanders answering your questions. Our number 866-303-2270. Bernie Sanders, not a Democrat, not a Republican, an independent member of the United States Senate. I think of him as America's senator. Amy in San Diego, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders. Amy? No, Amy. Okay, let's go to Robin in Seattle. Whoop. How did that happen? Now we've got two lines up. I don't get it. We'll try this one more time. Michael in Anaheim. Michael, can you hear me? He can't. Okay, Bernie, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, all right. So that side of the call screening board is working, so I'm going to pop people down on that side and see what happens. Michael in Anaheim, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you're live and on the air with Bernie.
Good morning, Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Michael.
I just have a brief comment on free trade.
Yes.
Free trade is protectionism. It protects multinational corporations against 200 million working Americans. And when the right wing says we want the same thing, we just have a different way of going about it, tell them we did it your way for 30 years and it's a failure no more.
Michael, I agree very, very strongly, and I think what you're going to see now in the Congress, far more opposition to unfettered free trade, to the NAFTAs, CAFTAs, permanent normal trade relations with China than we have seen in the past. And I agree with you. We have, I think, an $800 billion trade deficit. We have lost millions of good blue-collar jobs. We're at the cusp and are losing millions of good-paying white-collar information technology jobs. We have got to develop trade policies which work well for the middle class and working families of America, not just the large multinational corporations who pushed this whole set of policies down the throat of the United States Congress.
Tony in Florida, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Hey, Bernie, I just wanted to call and tell you a few years ago I met you up in Vermont. I had just retired and I had a house in Florida for the winter, Vermont for the summer. You told me, register in Florida. They need your vote much more down there than I do up here, and you were exactly right. I'm in one of the politically backward areas of Florida that voted for Gene Harris. But I just wanted to tell you, I pulled into a meeting of a Democratic club the other night, and I had my Vermont plates on, of course, and a Bernie sticker on the back, and I was an instant hero. So even in the hinterlands of the South, you've got a core following, and like Tom says, you are America's senator. Just keep being Bernie and keep up the good work. I worked on your campaign out of Orleans, even though I couldn't vote for you. And just keep it up, Bernie.
Hey, Tony, thanks very much. And I just want to say something. This is not about me, and I very much appreciate Tony's kind words. The truth is that the American people, working families, middle-income people, want to see the United States Senate stand up boldly and change the national priorities of this country. And I think we need grassroots America to give some backbone to some of the members of the Senate and the House who are just ever so worried about antagonizing big corporations and wealthy individuals from whom they get their campaign contributions, which then speaks to the need for public funding of elections. But we need grassroots America to say, you know what, you can vote against corporate America. You can vote to demand that the wealthiest people in this country start paying their fair share of taxes. You know what? We're behind you because we think it's more important to adequately fund education and health care and environmental protection and the needs of our kids. So stand tall, Senate, stand tall, House, we're behind you.
In other words, you guys need to be hearing from us.
Grassroots America. I mean, because what happens, you know, not in my case, but you have some of these guys are worried, my God, if I vote to ask the wealthiest people to stop paying their fair share, they're not going to contribute to my campaign. How do I get reelected? Well,
yeah.
And what ordinary people have to say is there are a lot more of us. There are a lot more working people, middle-class people, than there are millionaires. And if you do the right thing, we'll be behind you. On the contrary,
right.
If you don't,
right.
We ain't going to be there.
Yeah, and we'll send $25 to your campaign.
That's
on the
right.
Website and
that's
you know, that
right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. But it also speaks to the need to radically reform how campaigns are funded right now.
Right. Amen. Ian in San Francisco, we have about a minute before we have to take a break, Ian.
Okay, good morning, Tom, and good afternoon, Bernie. You got a lot of support out here in San Francisco, too. I want you to know that.
Thanks, Ian.
You know, the president talks a lot about how he has the people serve at his pleasure. Well, I think that the Congress needs to stand up and say, when you commit high crimes and misdemeanors, you serve at our pleasure. And I think that point needs to be made. And I think American people need to understand that high crimes and misdemeanors aren't necessarily exactly the same thing as crimes that you go to jail for. It's the kind of crime you can commit only because you're in the position you're in. And so I think Mr. Gonzalez needs to be our first target for impeachment. And I think that the Congress will have a lot of support if they do that.
Well, I think what I and a number of other people, including a few Republicans, have now asked for Gonzalez's resignation. And I think one of the strong reasons for moving in that direction is that when Bush brings forth a new nominee for Attorney General, we can go through a primer as to what the Constitution of the United States is and demand that a new Attorney General maybe read the Constitution and abide by that Constitution.
Yeah, it would be a novel idea for this administration. It would. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. It's 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls. 1-866-303-2270. Jan in Milford, Connecticut. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Can you hear
Hello,
me?
Jan.
Hi, Jan.
I would like to know why the word treason hasn't yet been used when it comes to the Valerie Plame issue. If, indeed, she was covert, working on a project connected with the war, and people may or may not have died by her outing. Why isn't the word treason being used?
Well, I think what is being used is that for the first time in 6 years, we now have a Congress which is prepared to at least raise those questions. Doesn't matter what words are being used. Valerie Plame, in fact, testified under oath before a committee. And you're seeing that not just with the Valerie Plame issue. You're seeing it with many other issues, how we got into the war, the role of private contractors in Iraq. I think you named the issue. We are beginning for the first time in 6 years to have the United States Congress begin to ask some very, very hard questions. And we'll take that, you know, right now I know that certainly in the Judiciary Committee, both in the Senate and the House, you're seeing Pat Leahy, John Conyers, now demanding that people like Karl Rove be subpoenaed with regard to trying to understand what the White House and what they knew about the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. So I think you're beginning to see some progress, finally, in holding this Bush administration accountable. I would like to move as aggressively as possible in that area.
Leland in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I'd just like to you to know that here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, we were successful at moving a resolution to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney through all three committees assigned in the Senate before we were subsequently opposed vigorously and unable to get the issue to a debate on the floor. I had two questions. One is, how do you feel about this Iraq supplemental appropriations budget? And the other one was, what other types of legislation and programs can we get behind in order to move towards that bioregional?
That's a good question. It's a very practical question. The reality right now is I believe, I don't know at what time today the House is going to be voting on their supplemental. From what I read, it is going to pass by a few votes, and I think that that is a good thing, obviously. I think we have got to use the budget to tell this president, finally, that he cannot continue this war to go on endlessly. The Iraqi people are going to have to take responsibility. We've got to help them, but not with our troops. We've got to bring our troops home as soon as possible. In the Senate, we have less support than we do with Tim Johnson being in the hospital. It really is a 50-49 split. We have at least one Democrat who is sympathetic to the Republican position on that position. So we're in a more difficult position, not to mention that if the Republicans insist to take 60 votes to pass anything significant, that's where we are. That's the reality. But I think there is zero question that the momentum is with those of us who understand this war has been a disaster from day one, that we were misled into this war, and that we've got to bring our troops home as soon as possible. What you're going to see is, I hope, some wavering Democrats come to our side and more Republicans understand not only that the war is in every sense wrong, but from a political perspective, the longer they stay with the president, the less likely they are going to be reelected. And you're seeing some of these guys now beginning, who are up for reelection, beginning to think twice about the war.
Dave in Chicago, Illinois, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I just wanted to commend you for being a true independent.
Thank you, Dave.
Realize it was kind of a theme. It seems like we've lost a lot of our independence with the news media,
yeah,
with representatives in Congress, with our election officials in Ohio and Florida, now the U.S. attorneys. And it seems like some of the few agencies that really have respect of a lot of people are like the Government Accounting Office, the Congressional Budget Office, agencies that have been set up to be independent. And, I mean, I'd love to see some more agencies set up like that, like a Congressional Investigations Office that would constantly monitor and audit all the senators and representatives, you know, so you could find out things like Ney and Jefferson and Cunningham and all these people that are doing things. I mean, there's no reason not to have all that stuff out in the open and have somebody looking over your shoulder, or a Congressional Survey Office where the professional survey people.
Well, you're right. I mean,
you know, to know what the American people think. I mean, get professionals who ask, you know, non-slanted but not, you know, and unbiased questions.
Well, I think you're right, and I think one of the problems, and I'm just thinking about it today, and I don't know how to resolve it, is the truth of the matter is Congress is enormous, in one sense at least, an enormously complicated institution, in that you have authorizations, you have appropriations, you have supplemental bills. It is, you can almost have any member of Congress in the Senate tell you all of the wonderful things. I introduced this bill and I voted for that bill, which may have meaning nothing because the day before they voted for something else that was very different, that was much more significant. And how we bring, your point is, how do we bring more transparency to government, which is right? How do we simplify the process so that people really know what their senators and congresspeople are doing on the real issues and hold them accountable? And you touched on, Dave, the very important issue of media. And Tom and I have talked about this quite often. In terms of at least radio and television, I think that we have got to strengthen the FCC to say to these radio and television stations, the airwaves are owned by the people. You have been given a limited amount of spectrum space that's available, And you have certain responsibilities, and your responsibility is not just to make as much money as you possibly can. It is to educate. It is to inform the American people who are living in a democratic society. And that's an issue, by the way, that we are working very hard, and we're going to introduce some major legislation reasonably soon, which takes us back to the 1930s Communications Act, which speaks to the responsibility of radio and now television, who use the public airways and how they have got to be accountable to the American people, not just to their profit motives.
Back to programming in the public interest.
Right.
Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
All right. Hi, Senator. All right. I'm from Western Mass, so hi, neighbor. Yes, I've got a question for you, Senator. All right, seeing how this Iraq war is all basically about oil, you know, so let's face it, you know, that's basically what it's about. All right, is there a way that we could declare like a state of emergency and put funding in for like alternative energy, and that way there we could tell the Middle East to keep their oil?
Well, certainly, Steve, there is no question that the issue of oil, the issue of energy has foreign policy implications, which is what you're talking about. In this case, a terrible war and a lot of conflict in Iraq, in the Middle East, supporting governments in the Middle East who are authoritarian above and beyond where we are in Iraq. No question to my mind. I agree with Al Gore that this planet faces an emergency. We have got to tomorrow begin breaking our dependency on fossil fuel in general, not just oil, but fossil fuel in general. And the good news, the really exciting news, is that the technology is now available in sustainable energy, whether it is solar, whether it is wind, whether it's geothermal, whether it's biofuels. It is sitting there waiting to happen. And we are working, I'm on the Energy Committee, and we are working very hard to move this country in a very, very different direction in terms of energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
And good on that. Great. Gabe in Ventura, California. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Senator. Hey, Tom. First of all, I want to say you guys are both tremendous. I feel, Tom, that you add the highest level of discourse to the airwaves that I can't hear on any other programs, even on others in Air America, and really the most percipient analysis of the crisis we find ourselves in. My question is really about, and it's a good segue from the last caller, in that we talk about alternative energy as being some sort of a panacea, but I don't think that there's nothing questioning the American level of consumerism and the current way, and we're seeing ripples of that in the housing crisis that's happening, over the fact that we basically designed these communities that aren't worth defending, that aren't sustainable, and I don't think that there's any amount of biomass that we're going to be able to use to keep our freeway systems going the way that we are. And shouldn't we, in fact, be questioning this whole notion of building cities that are completely dependent upon cars? I know, Tom, you live in Portland.
Yeah.
Bernie is from Vermont, and there are actually – and those are some of the very, like, aberrant examples of communities that have had some forethought in the way that they actually plan themselves. I work as a union organizer, and I don't think it's any secret that we have one of the lowest levels of class consciousness in a society because of the fact that we don't have any communities more. And I think there's a much bigger price, even than the environmental price, for people. So I'd like to respond to that.
Dave raises a lot of good issues. One way that we're beginning to look at the problem that Dave raises about the amount of energy that is wasted in homes is to begin the process of making sure that when a new home is being built, that it is energy efficient. If you talk to architects, they will tell you simply by the direction in which you site a home, whether it's facing the sun or not, is enormously important. The kind of appliances that we use, the kind of insulation that we use, we can do infinitely better. Dave also raises the question about keeping people closer to their work and breaking our dependence on the automobile. That ain't going to happen tomorrow, but he's right, moving toward that direction.
And planning communities well and appropriately. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 1-866-303-2270. And John in Temecula, California, if I'm pronouncing that right, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Temecula. Good morning, Tom. Good morning,
you.
Senator. It's very, you know, disappointing to hear that Democrats can't even come together on raising taxes on people that really are the minority in this country, but it seems they have a majority voice. And like Barbara Boxer said, you know, elections have consequences, and if they don't get it together, 2008 will have consequences. But the reason I'm calling is I only hear this on Lou Dobbs about this North American Union, and I was wondering if you have any update, or it's quite concerning to me that we're going to sit here and unionize with countries that don't even agree with our laws half the time.
Well, I think that's ain't going to happen. I mean, what you are seeing, and I think this is part of the goal of corporate America, is to see closer and closer economic ties with developing countries where in some cases workers are paid 30 or 40 cents an hour. And the closer you unite the United States to those countries, obviously it works for the large corporations who then can drive wages down in the United States or utilize the cheap labor in foreign countries. But and then you got the whole World Trade Organization and so forth and so on. So needless to say, I am very opposed to that trend. We want strong international relations, which help the developing countries of the world improve their standard of living, improve their environmental capabilities, but we have to do it in a way that protects the middle class and working families of this country and protects the Constitution of the United States, which makes us a free country.
Bill in Queens, New York, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello. You know, I quite agree that that Vice President Gore's testimony before Congress really poses the sharpness of the emergency facing the planet. But I really don't hear necessarily, even from him, measures that are equal to the radicality of this crisis and needed to address it. For example, in this country, you know, up to World War II, we had a rail system that was the envy of the world. Now it's the joke of the world. And I don't see a commitment coming from Congress to rebuild a national rail system, both local and regional light rail and intercity high-speed passenger rail of the kind you have in Europe and Japan. It would be a public works project that would create thousands of good-paying jobs that would have a multiplier effect for the economy and would cut down on car and jet travel, which are two of the main contributors to carbon emissions. Is there such an initiative on the horizon, and if not, why not?
Well, Bill, I think you're absolutely right. When we talk about global warming and breaking our dependence on fossil fuels, mass transportation is certainly one of the tools that we have to use, and you're absolutely right. Compared to Europe, Japan, even China, we are falling further and further behind. Bill, what you have to appreciate, you can be justifiably critical of Congress, that's fine, but we have a president of the United States who really does not believe in government very much at all. It certainly has not been supportive of Amtrak, and would probably veto any legislation along with many Republicans who do not support Amtrak, of creating the kind of rail system, national rail system for passengers, for cargo, that we absolutely need. But that is something that I am committed to, and there are a number of us who are. If we want to break our dependency on the automobile, if we want to lower pollution in America, certainly mass transportation is right at the top of the list of things we have to do.
Joe in Long Island, New York. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is about voting machines. When I was in the service, we worked on equipment, and they were built to military standards or to government standards. Why can't our government have their own voting machine built to government standards without a propriety issue from Diebold or ESNS, that it belongs to the government, it's run on their programs, and there would be no propriety issue with companies when it came to either putting in paper trails or going back and checking data or anything like that. It belongs to the government.
Joe, the real debate now, and Tom and I have discussed this many, many times, is the unacceptability of having voting machines, touchscreen voting machines all over this country, in which people are concerned that the votes that they cast may not ever be counted. And there's a big deal in Florida right now in a congressional election as to whether or not the machine malfunctioned completely. My own view, and you're seeing more and more, and here's an example, a really good example, where grassroots America is standing up and change is taking place. You have the governor of Florida, Republican governor, saying he now wants to move away from touchscreen machines. So when you talk about standards, I think one of the standards that we have to discuss is whether or not the technology is now there at all to be confident about touchscreen voting machines. I would be one of those people to say we're not there yet. Let's not use them. There are other technologies that we're 100% confident in. So
paper.
Among other things, paper, right.
Yeah. Terry in Louisville, Colorado. We just have about 30 seconds, Terry.
Senator, I've got an idea for solar energy that makes so much sense, I wonder why nobody else has come up with it. Basically, what I hear about criticism of solar is that you have to buy or lease the land, then you have to run transmission lines and maybe even build access highways for a large solar farm. Why don't we use, like, say, Interstate 70, 80, and 90? The medians are 6,000 miles long. We own the land. We've got transmission lines near them. And there's a highway pretty close by, too.
Well, it's an interesting idea. I can't give you a definitive answer, but what I can say is both in terms of small-scale solar on people's homes and in building and large-scale plants, I think we've got to be very aggressive.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for the great work you're doing and for being on our program every week.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye now. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. A correspondent, author of the New York Times bestseller, Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court. Jan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
I find this fascinating, the entire topic of this book, how the court has genuinely shifted to the right, and yet there's still this, from your book, there's still this notion that Kennedy might be a swing vote and that anything could happen in the next year and a half as there's the possibility that Bush could really nail the court right, or that if the court is intact through the end of his presidency, that it could go back to a more moderate court.
Well, I think that the court has certainly turned to the right, and I believe George Bush has succeeded in doing that, where other Republican presidents for 30 years have tried to do it and failed. With those nominations of Roberts and Alito, he has turned that court in a more conservative course. Because, you know, just face it, I mean, Justice Alito is much more conservative than the justice he replaced, Sandra Day O'Connor. And, you know, she was the one who was casting that key fifth vote with the liberals on all those big social issue cases that everyone cares about, whether it's abortion or affirmative action or religion or presidential power, on and on down the line. So just the fact that President Bush has put a solid judicial conservative, someone who's not going to get on that court and drift to the left once, you know, he starts getting criticized by the New York Times, that is a significant achievement for the president, and is also quite significant that he has put John Roberts, you know, a young guy, a brilliant guy, a collegial, congenial guy, in the center of that court, leading that court for at least a generation. Now, of course, we've just got four solid conservatives on the court now. You've got Justices Thomas and Scalia and then the two new guys, which then leads us to look to Justice Kennedy, you know, the man in the middle, nominated by President Reagan, obviously a tremendous disappointment to conservatives. But I believe that Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, will have much more luck in bringing Kennedy over to the conservative side than the Chief Justice, the old Chief Justice Rehnquist, ever did. Because Rehnquist, you know, he didn't try to build those coalitions. He didn't reach out across, you know, the aisle to colleagues and try to persuade and bring them over. And then the other point to make is that Kennedy, at the end of the day, is just more conservative than O'Connor. So even if he's the swing vote, he's a more conservative swing vote. He's much more willing to allow restrictions on abortion. He is much more willing to allow, you know, kind of religion in the public square, and all those kind of cases where O'Connor refused and where O'Connor went with the liberals. Kennedy, you know, raised affirmative action. Kennedy's with the conservatives. So sure, you know, there's still one, you know, there's one guy who's not that solid all the time, but certainly President Bush has really made quite a difference in the future of this Supreme Court.
Do you really think it's reasonable to call the other five justices who are not right-wing ideologues liberals?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you're talking about
Why?
The other four. You're talking about...
Well, yeah, separate of Kennedy.
Yeah, I mean you're talking about Stevens, Ginsburg, Souter, and Breyer.
Right,
and,
I'm sure you might apply that legitimately to Ginsburg, but the other three seem to be... I mean, they're it seems, you know, judicially that they're more moderate than the court was during Eisenhower's time, certainly more moderate than the Warren court was.
No, there's no question. I would never suggest this is a liberal court, and I certainly don't in my book. I mean, this is not a court, you know, that is as liberal as the Warren court, but certainly this is a court with those seven justices nominated by Republican presidents that was quite a disappointment to conservatives. And on all those cases, those big social issue cases, those four justices take a predictable liberal path. I mean, just look at some of the decisions that, you know, they've issued over the years, whether it's been abortion, affirmative action, you know, the death penalty, gay rights. I mean, that those justices have taken that path to the left. Now, where you have seen a change and where this court is more conservative and was more conservative under Rehnquist was that you didn't see that kind of language that we saw in the 60s and in the 70s where the justices would write opinions talking about things that outrage the conscience or, you know, that just it would be untenable on its face. I mean, obviously this is a court that's more conservative in that sense and that it does demand, you know, closer look at the text and the language, that those kind of arguments have to be more closely tailored. And I think that's probably Chief Justice Rehnquist's greatest legacy. He did change the language.
To what extent, Jan Crawford Greenberg, the author of Supreme Conflict, The Inside of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court, to what extent do you think that the baggage of Bush's nominees is going to follow them? For example, Roberts was the guy who, in the 2000 election, which we know now, you know, after the New York Times, well, actually the newspaper consortium counted all the ballots down in Florida. The New York Times reported a week after or a month after 9/11 on November 11th, actually, that when they actually counted the ballots, no matter how you counted it, pregnant Chad, dimple Chad, pimple Chad, intent of voter, undervotes, overvotes, by any measure, Al Gore actually got more votes in Florida than Bush had. And so if the Supreme Court had not stopped the vote, Al Gore would have been president. And John Roberts was the guy who went down to Florida, who had clerked for Rehnquist, and so went down to Florida and basically trained the lawyers on how to make an argument before Rehnquist.
That's totally false. I mean, Roberts was very minimally involved in Bush versus Gore.
He was down in Florida for 2.5 weeks training lawyers.
He was in Florida because he was adopting a child, and he was very and that's why he and his wife both were down there. He just happened to be in Florida. He didn't go to try to do any major role in Bush versus Gore at all. And in fact, people had wanted John Roberts, and if they had asked if he could take more of a role in that case, and he said he couldn't, and that's when Ted Olson stepped in and picked up the slack. So, I think you can legitimately criticize the Rehnquist court for its decision in Bush versus Gore. You can look at that opinion based on equal protection grounds and scratch your head and say, what in the world were they thinking? But I certainly don't think that you can say, you know, John Roberts, I mean, he's a lawyer. So what? I mean, he didn't cast a vote in Bush versus
Gore. No, he was volunteering his services
down
there. Then what about Sam Alito being the author during the Reagan administration of this whole idea of signing statements? I mean, is this something that's going to come to haunt him?
No, I don't think that's true either. I mean, signing statements is something that presidents have used for, you know, 100 years and certainly...
No, but Alito was the one who suggested the signing statements could be used to change the actual meaning of legislation. He's quite proud of it.
I don't know what your point is.
Well, that you know, increasingly this idea that President Bush signing statements on legislation is there's growing criticism of it.
If there were to be a case before, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe he would have to recuse himself if there were ever a case, you know, on the constitutionality of signing statements. I mean, I would probably guess, wouldn't you, that maybe a lawyer would say, you know, he should have to step down because he's taken a position on it in the past. That's
probably
how that would play out.
Although the court doesn't always do that. I mean, in Bush v. Gore, you had three members of the court who had members of their immediate families who were working on the Bush campaign, and none recused themselves. So there's
no, those decisions are very much up to the justices. There's no kind of written rule on how they recuse themselves or what they do.
What's the role of the Federalist Society in all this, Jandrea?
Well, the Federalist Society, you know, is this very conservative legal group that is kind of, you know, the counterpart to some of the liberal legal groups that we have seen take a role in recommending potential nominees and talking with the White House, not only in this administration but in past administrations, you know, kind of pushing their views. And the Federalist Society is obviously different from those groups, other kind of conservative groups like, say, the Southern Baptist Convention, which, you know, we also saw kind of had an opinion on the Harriet Myers nomination, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
They are much more, you know, kind of looking at the law and how, you know, they think the Constitution should be read in this certain way, as opposed to, like, the other conservative.
Well, the Federalist Society is all about policy.
I guess. I mean, it's just more of a legal group as opposed to, like, a religious group or, you know, other kind of conservative organization that might want to make its views known as well.
But I understand that more than half of federal judges now are members of the Federalist Society. And this is a group that's only, what, 35, 40 years old?
Yeah, those are statistics that I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think is the future of this court? What kind of decisions can we see coming down the road as a result?
Oh, I mean, just like we started off this conversation, I mean, I think George Bush succeeded in changing that direction of the Supreme Court. And I think you're going to see a much more conservative court. You're going to see, you know, starting this term with some of these huge blockbuster cases we've got this term.
By a conservative court, do you mean that, for example, they will roll back or they will sustain the suspension of, say, or the elimination of habeas corpus?
Well, they don't have a case that term. I mean, this term. I'm talking about abortion, affirmative action. They've got a big global warming case. And I think when you're starting to
talk about... But it seems like the really important liberal versus conservative issues have to do with civil liberties. And I mean, that's the real meat, I think, of Americanism, you know, of what it is.
Well, I mean, I think all these issues are incredibly significant to all of our daily lives. And so the way the Supreme Court decides them has an enormous effect on all of us. And I agree with you, of course, that habeas is extraordinarily important. And I think there's where you're going to see Kennedy stepping in and probably making a difference. And we'll see where the Bush administration is still one short, because on presidential power in those cases, Kennedy doesn't go along with the conservatives.
Yeah, interesting. Jan Crawford Greenberg, author of Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court. Thanks for being with us, Jan.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Listen in to a radio station where a mighty host live and sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to feel those good vibrations coming from the joy that's looking great, turn your radio on.
Radio, turn your radio on.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People here in the United States of America. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Iran has seized 15 British sailors. This is interesting. This happened, or this story broke about an hour and a half ago, and maybe an hour ago. And I was sitting here with David, my producer, and you know, he said, "Hey, the wire service says that the Iranians have seized some soldiers, some British soldiers." And I said, "Oh, interesting. Let's compare the coverage of this between Drudge and New York Times online, because this will give us a clue as to whether the the right wing is going to try and use this to whip up a war with Iran or not. You know, oh, boy, an opportunity. And sure enough, it was right up there at the top of Drudger, the big screaming headline, and New York Times was just another story. We have yet to find out how big a story this is going to be, but it appears that it's, you know, one of those. Well, we just don't know. Nobody knows at this point. A British naval patrol was out in the waters. They say the waters of Iraq. The story in the New York Times says it was in the waters that separate Iraq from Iranian waters. And so the Iranians, we haven't heard from them yet. I'm predicting they will claim that the British had wandered into their territorial waters, and the British will say, no, we didn't. And the British were out in these inflatable rafts, you know, these kind of Zodiac boats, checking for contraband, for smuggling. In fact, one of the reports was that they were looking for the smuggling of automobiles, oddly enough. And so the Iranians said, okay, you guys, come with us. And they have them now. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on this and let you know what's going on. Also, the House of Representatives has passed a timetable for getting the troops out of Iraq. This is the Iraq Supplemental Bill. And this is a really interesting piece of legislation in that it has divided the progressive community. And this is one of the things I find most interesting about this. And a number of progressives in the House of Representatives went over to the moderate Democratic side and voted in favor of this thing. And some of the conservative Democrats decided, okay, they'd go along with it. This is a bill that says, okay, we're still going to have a war until August of 2008, but there are all these specific milestones and benchmarks. And you know, basically, it's the folks who are in favor of it, which includes MoveOn.org, which I find fascinating. And I would say the reason why I find it fascinating is because the question, as a MoveOn.org member, the question that I got was basically, do you support the Democrats' move to do this or not? Or not sure? And it seems to me that the question should have been, do you support the Democrats' move to end the war by October of 2008, or would you support the Progressive Caucus's suggestion to end the war within 6 months, or Jack Murtha's proposal, for example. But because it was presented as a take-it-or-leave-it kind of thing, I think a lot of MoveOn members voted for it that way. And the reality is, politically, it is a take-it-or-leave-it thing. So, you know, I'm not condemning MoveOn.org for that. On the other hand, I think the presentation of this was a little less transparent than it could have been. But the unfortunate reality is, as at least, you know, I've gotten from several members of Congress, Brian Baird and Peter DeFazio, talking to the members of the House of Representatives, Peter DeFazio, arguably one of the most progressive of the members of the House of Representatives, is that if this thing failed, if this piece of legislation failed, then basically a bill saying, okay, George, here's your money, is what would have to go. And Bush is already threatening to veto this. So this is, you know, part of a spine. It's a little bit of standing up. And even this probably won't make it through the Senate, where it's going to take, you know, if the Republicans decide that they're going to filibuster something, it's going to take 60 votes to get it through. And they were able to just muster 128 votes in the House to push this thing through. And as I recall, and, you know, it's just a beginning, right, for this $128 billion supplemental is war appropriation. And at that, the Democrats had to sweeten the bill for a few members. I'm sorry, 218 to 212 was the vote. They had to sweeten it for some of their members to get them on board. So, you know, Nancy Pelosi doing deal-making in the fine tradition of Tip O'Neill and Lyndon Johnson and other former speakers of the House who, for that matter, Tom DeLay, or Denny Hastert, or I guess Tom DeLay wasn't the speaker, but the Denny Hastert and others who have been able to pull together coalitions, have been able to herd cats. On the other hand, a lot of people saying, wait a minute, we should have just said, are we out of there or not? I mean, that was the position that a lot of progressives were taking. Now that it's passed the House, I think, you know, now it's going to go to the Senate. That debate is going to begin there, hopefully. And I think it's a good time now in the House to say, okay, now let's try putting forward a piece of legislation that is even more restrictive, that says, you know, no, we're not going to wait until just before the next presidential election to wrap up this war so that the Republicans can use it as a campaign stump speech. The Democrats won't get credit for it, I guarantee you. The president will take credit for it. Instead, let's wrap up this war right now. I mean, enough killing already, enough death already. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for the sponsors on your local radio station and patronizing those sponsors and letting them know that you're listening. Also, our national sponsors, sacredgroundscoffee.com, smalldog.com, Small Dog Electronics, EcoWine, 1-888-EcoWine, the organic wine company, and Purina One Natural Blends at 1-866-380-MEOW. Interesting news out there, yes. If you want to end global warming, cut down on flying, sell a car, recycle your bottles. No, if you really want to end global warming, stop the cows from burping. This is the latest from The Guardian. In England, a scientist in Germany has invented a pill to stop cows from burping methane. Methane in the atmosphere has increased sixfold over the last 50 years, and it's a very, very powerful greenhouse gas. So this is going to boost the cow's metabolism and let them produce more milk because they're producing glucose instead of burping, and isn't that a fine thing? I don't know. My take on it is if you want to end methane as a consequence of factory farming, you know, encourage vegetarianism. Pretty simple. And let's take just a quick look here at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And they're alive in the barracks.
Following a security developments in Iraq as of 08:45 Greenwich Mean Time today, Friday, Dateline Baghdad. This is all from Reuters, by the way. Dateline Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb that hit his patrol in western Baghdad. In Najaf, a suicide car bomb exploded near a police checkpoint, wounding three policemen. The suicide bomber survived the blast and was captured by police as he tried to run away. In Diwania, police said they found the bodies of two policemen on Thursday. The men have been shot. In Yusufia, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed one policeman and wounded two. In Mosul, police said the bodies of four people, including two teenagers, were found on Thursday in Mosul, 390 kilometers north of Baghdad. The victims had been tortured and handcuffed before being killed, including the two teenagers. In Tikrit, police found the bodies of a police lieutenant colonel and his driver in Al-Dur, near the town of Tikrit. The two had been kidnapped on Thursday. Grim news. Our telephone number, 303-2270, 1-866-303-2270, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to discuss an issue that I think is more important than our dependency on foreign oil, and that's not just, I guess, foreign corporations, but large corporations in general. It seems to me that not only states or, you know, and federal government, but county government depends so strongly on these large corporations for our tax base that they've essentially forgotten, you know, the development of manufacturing in their own, you know, regions, as well as, you know, trying to foster small business in order to develop a long-term financial stability. You know, what happens if one of these large corporations decides they're not getting enough of a tax break and they decide to move?
Yeah, well, it happens all the time. Yeah, it happens all the time, and many of them are moving out of the United States. And this is the predictable consequence of two things, in large part. The first being in the early 1980s, Ronald Reagan saying that he essentially was not going to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act any longer. So you had this mergers and acquisitions mania that was unlike anything that we'd seen since the 1890s, the 1880s in the United States, the era of the robber barons, where all these huge conglomerates came together and you know, companies buying companies buying companies, and media companies ending up being owned by defense contractors and everything else. One, that part of it. And two, the end, the progressive, it was gradual for about a 15-year period, and then Clinton kicked the door open with NAFTA and GATT, the progressive end of protective tariffs that said, you know, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made here, and you're going to make those in China where there's 20 cents worth of labor, you're going to pay an 80-cent tax when we import them. And you combine those things, and what you have is this great leveling, you know, the flattening of the earth, as Thomas Friedman is so enthusiastic about. And the consequence of that is that industrialized countries get whacked. And third world countries think they're going to do really well, and they do over the short period of time. But what happens is that it's the elites who really make out well. Billionaires like Tom Friedman, people who live primarily by their investments, or who are the major multinational corporations. They're the big winners in this so-called globalization. All the rest of us are losers. Russell in Oxford, Mississippi, listening in WSMB. Hey, Russell.
Hey. Yeah.
What's up?
Good program this morning. Hey, I was curious about the Baghdad Green Zone attacks. How many of those guards were the Blackwater guys? And in the legislation that they just passed, are we going to be pulling the contractors out, the Blackwater, the mercenaries? Or are they coming out?
No, off here. The bottom line, though, in answer to your question, with regard to the contractors, is there's no way of knowing, because the contract, you know, it's like a black box. The Bush administration says we need these many dollars, and the breakout has never been carefully examined. At least as far as I've been able to tell, I've talked to a number of legislators and said, you know, do you know where this money is going? No. There's no audit of the Defense Department. They're not, you know, there's $2 trillion missing from the Defense Department right now. Nobody knows where it is. There's $8 billion missing in Iraq in cash. Nobody knows where it is. So, no, I would say, part of this money, no doubt, is going to end up with these contractors, these so-called contractors, and, or mercenary armies, or whatever you want to call it. And we're not going to know what it is. Mike in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, John O'Neill inspector,
Michael O'Neill
inspector's office, did he break the law by sliding that thing into the Patriot?
No, he, assuming that, I mean, he might have done the sort of thing that the inspector could fire him for, but to the best of my knowledge, he didn't break the law. But then I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a prosecutor. I mean, it's probably something worth investigating. The fact that our inspector didn't know that this thing had been put into the Patriot Act over his name and was all surprised about it later either indicates that this guy did it without inspectors knowing about it, or maybe it happened. I mean, it happened in March of a year ago. Of 2006, and as I recall, that was when our inspector was going through some pretty rough chemotherapy. So it may have been that he just was too sick to notice. Or even had a conversation and didn't remember it and was, you know, medicated or something. I just, you know, bottom line, I don't know. But it is something that should be looked into, in my opinion, you know, very carefully. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. My antenna is up. It's Friday, you know, slow news day. And the House just passed this thing on the funding the Iraqi thing.
Yeah.
And then this thing pops up about Iranians seize British soldiers.
Right. And go ahead.
At any rate, I'm concerned. Is the House and Senate, are they going to be in D.C. over the weekend? Because I'm thinking.
No.
Oh, God. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I'm really scared, quite frankly, that this is.
Well, I, you know, if the Democrats hadn't taken control of the House and Senate, my guess is that this would be the incident that would have started the war, because we were hearing in September, October, November, even December after the elections, we were hearing virtually identical rhetoric out of the administration and in the corporate media from what we heard 4 years ago. It was a clear run-up to war against Iran. And once the Democrats actually started holding hearings and doing investigations, and in some ways people started actually, and the Libby trial was a part of this, looking behind the curtain at what's going on with the media in the United States, all of a sudden it came to a screeching halt. And I haven't been hearing the drums of war in the last 2 months. I don't think most of us have. And frankly, I think that this administration has been paused. And, Scott Ritter had predicted on this program almost a year ago that sometime in March or April, mm-hmm. this administration would be attacking Iran. And I am cautiously optimistic as a consequence of the election of the Democrats, that's not going to happen.
Well, I'm going to call my congressmen and senators anyway and say, I am really panicked about this. So be ready to fly back to D.C.
Yeah, amen. And just say, we don't want an invasion of Iran. Thank you very much. Well said, Karen. Thank you. Josh in New York City. Hey, Josh, got about a minute before we've got to take a break here. What's up?
Sure thing. Just wanted to comment on Tony Snow saying that Congress has no oversight of the president, and how that cannot really get noticed in the mainstream media, where that's really just kind of against everything the Constitution stands for.
Yeah, and in fact, Snow saying that the two branches don't have the right to look over each other right after the executive branch put Duke Cunningham from the legislative branch in jail. A little weird. I would suggest that
Tony it's Snow all fairly convenient, but that's just it's checks and balances. That's basic civics right there.
Yeah, civics 101. No, the Congress has a requirement to exercise oversight over both of the other branches of government, they're at every level. Each branch has some requisite ability, some required ability, some obligation to provide oversight to the others, and to provide. That's the check and balance part of it. And Tony Snow doesn't get it, Josh. I mean, that's just the bottom line. He just doesn't get it, or maybe he does, and he just can't say it. And that's actually probably more accurate depiction of it. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good. Be right back.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. You're light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's Air America Radio. Tom Hartman with you nine and a half minutes before the hour. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Excellent. Thank you. I'm very aware that it's Friday afternoon.
Yes, and so are the members of Congress, apparently. The House, Nancy Pelosi finally got her vote.
She got a vote. She got 218, which means that it moves forward to the Senate. In the meantime, the president is speaking in just a few minutes, actually. He'll be speaking, and I have to tell you, this is going to be a surprise to you, Tom. He's not going to be supportive of this.
Yeah, this is a surprise. Yeah,
he's not going to be supportive of the idea of having a date certain, or at least a date by which time the troops will come home. Tony Snow addressed this in the briefing today and suggested also that the troops would not be supportive of this. Apparently he must have had some kind of psychic poll done of the troops. And
that contradicts the major polls that have been done, like the Pew poll and the Zogby polls that were done.
Well,
that showed that the troops wanted to come home, a majority of them.
Apparently he's got access to different polling data.
Yeah, indeed. And the this capture by the Iranians of 15 British soldiers in the Gulf there. What's this, any news on this?
We really don't have very much news on this. The U.S. is leaving this to the British to deal with at this time. The British, not surprisingly, are royally ticked off about this. But we don't know what they're doing. We don't know what conversations have been had. As far as we know, the Iranians have made no statement. As far as we know, this was not something that was sanctioned by the government. It may have been, but we don't know that. We do not know if President Bush has spoken with Prime Minister Blair yet. So basically, we really know very little, except that we have condemned the act, obviously.
Indeed. And today the Washington Post is reporting that 2 months before Bud Cummings was fired as U.S. attorney in Little Rock, the federal prosecutor down in Little Rock, Tim Griffin, who was Karl Rove's protege and good buddy, was maneuvering with the Justice Department to take Cummings' place. Quoting the Washington Post, some of the thousands of pages of emails released this week underscore the extraordinary planning and effort at the highest levels of the Justice Department and White House to secure Griffin a job. And this kind of flies in the face of Gonzalez saying that that's not what it was all about and he would never do such a thing and blah, blah, blah. Is this adding fuel to the fire, or is this something that everybody just kind of assumed? Is you know, how incendiary is this little?
Well, I mean, I can only really speak to it from the point of view of, did it come up in the briefings today?
Right.
And the answer is no, it didn't.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't say that it's that incendiary. I would say that people kind of assumed that it was going on. I think that people also assume that it's quite possible that Gonzalez didn't know about it, because I think they're starting to think that he doesn't know very much of what goes on at the Justice Department.
Yeah, well, we'll find out if we can issue a subpoena. But, you know, a lot of these emails referred to conversations with Gonzalez. He just doesn't use email, so there's no paper trail on him.
Right.
Or at least no email paper trail. That's
right, no email paper trail. Right. I mean, maybe there are notes in his handwriting or something like that. But there really wasn't very much conversation about it. I don't think that it was a surprise to anybody.
Yeah.
To be honest with you.
Another U.S. attorney is speaking now. She has said that a senior Justice Department official, this is the New York Times, that a senior Justice Department official told her that her resignation was necessary to create a slot for an individual they wanted to advance. She said she wasn't told who that individual was, but basically she was bumped because the Bushies had somebody they wanted to put into her place. Again, the press corps isn't going crazy on this.
Not going crazy on that. Still going crazy on oaths and on where the negotiations are between Fred Fielding and the committee, and whether they're listening to Arlen Specter's compromise offer. And basically the answer is, we're not negotiating. That was the bottom line answer. We're talking to them, we're talking to them. He kept saying, we're talking, but the bottom line was, we are not negotiating. Now, I asked, in the light of a House Judiciary letter that came out yesterday that said, in the meantime, we ask that you ensure the preservation of relevant White House documents.
Mm-hmm.
I asked whether they should have any concern about the preservation of documents. And he gave me one word answer, which was no. So we now have on the record that we should have no concern that any documents have been shredded.
Yeah, just like you should have no concern about your habeas corpus rights.
Put it on the record.
At least, yeah, and that's good, and good on you for asking that question. Nora O'Donnell is arguably one of the most partisan of NBC and MSNBC's so-called reporters. She hectored, I don't have a better word for it, Pat Leahy today on the air. She said he's putting on a show trial. She said, you know, essentially, why do you want to put Karl Rove under oath? This is a quote from Laura O'Donnell. She said, you're going to get the truth in Karl Rove. What's wrong with that? You don't trust the White House. The bottom line is, you don't trust the White House. I mean, you know, badgering Pat Leahy, I'm astounded.
I was astonished when I read this also. I really was, because even though she may be partisan, she is supposed to be nominally nonpartisan when she's in that job.
Right. Well, this was on MSNBC. Is this an indication that MSNBC is trying to, you know, take a chunk out of Fox's ratings? Do you think that this has to do with the business of news rather than the news of news?
I would think it would probably have to do with the business of news, which, again, is incredibly depressing. Do they feel that they need to have some kind of a counter to Keith Olbermann? I mean, you really don't need to do that when Keith Olbermann's the one who's getting you the ratings. Maybe you need to have more of the same.
Yeah, well, and he's the only liberal on network television, and he's not even on network television, the cable television.
Right.
Surprising, startling.
It was very surprising to me because it was literally White House talking points. The phrase show trial is one of their talking points.
Yeah. And this is not a trial that anybody's talking about in the Senate. That would follow impeachment in the House.
They're just talking about hearings.
Yeah. Well, apparently Nora didn't get the memo, or maybe she did, and that's the problem. Anyhow, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
You know, I talked about this earlier in the week, briefly, just in a single segment, and I want to get back to it because I got a lot of email from people and some discussion over the forum, our message board, and saying, you know, what... Can you explain further what you're talking about? Tom, by the way, welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The psychological warfare that I suggested conservatives are waging right now against working people in the United States, and much of it, oddly, is taking the form of a war against women, or what is perceived as a war against women. Men, basically conservative men, slapping women upside the head in very public fashion, as a way of causing other primarily white, formerly working class or middle class males, but I'd say, you know, probably cuts across all lines, but that's primarily the audience for conservative talk radio and conservative television, causing them who are feeling insecure and concerned about their place in the economic world to think that fear and that anger that they are feeling as a consequence of globalization, as a consequence of the 26-year now war on the middle class ever since Reagan came into office in 81 and you know, busted PATCO and declared war on working people in the United States, the decline in union membership from 25% when Reagan came into office down to around 7% now in the private sector, all of that to redirect, trying to get average Americans to redirect their anger away from the robber barons, away from those who are doing the policy, and toward women. And it's continuing. It's continuing. I mean, this whole, here we have now, first of all, Limbaugh, talking about Edwards and his wife. John Edwards' wife has cancer. Okay, so let's criticize them, right? Let's just the most cynical thing.
I'm telling you, this is to jumpstart the campaign. This is to see if it'll jumpstart the campaign.
Yeah, see, she has cancer. That's going to really help the campaign tremendously. Well, actually, what he was talking about was the announcement that he's pulling out. No, he's not pulling out of the campaign. But still, the whole, let's just... He's just using her. Come on. And then you have Tucker Carlson. First of all, this was, you know, a couple of days ago talking about Hillary, that she's castrating.
It's not like Hillary's some communist or something. You know what I mean? She's no more liberal than Barack Obama. She's more conservative probably in some ways. There's just something about her that feels castrating, overbearing, and scary.
So you have Tucker being worried about being castrated. And then, you know, you have Michael Savage going off on Barbara Walters. Barbara Walters interviewing, I believe this was Hugo Chavez. And Michael Savage goes nuts.
Notice what this double-talking slut just did, this mind slut, Barbara Walters.
See, and then he goes on and on and on, you know, in that kind of variety of conversation.
And I stick by those words. She's an empty mind slut. She'd peddle anything for a ratings point. That mental prostitute, Walters, it sickens me. I think that the woman is vermin. I think she's dirt.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole idea of, oh, it's all women's fault. It's all about there's these women out there we need to worry about. Glenn Beck.
I can't take it that Rosie O'Donnell can be put on ABC television, mainstream, unquestioned by the mainstream media. She can say whatever she wants to say. She can take the sides with, what's his name, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Holy cow, she can say whatever she wants to say, and not only that.
What the hell is this show all about, you fat witch? What is this show about?
And so now her crime is that she is fat and a witch? I mean, at a certain point, you say, what? And then there's, of course, the old Limbaugh, the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox commercial.
If you order now, you can supersize your order in the double deluxe testicle lockbox, big enough for 8 dwarves and 8 moderators. This Christmas, give a gift to the woman who wants everything. Make it a Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, available everywhere. Power is great.
Yeah, right. And then even Bill O'Reilly. Apparently yesterday going off against his co-host, who's talking about, you know, the White House is saying that they will not have an oath. They will not allow an oath. In other words, it can't be under oath, and they will not allow transcripts. And O'Reilly somehow thinks that that is open transcripts.
Right.
That's right, but there's no transcript of it. There's no way that we're the people that are going to find out about it.
You see, I don't like you today.
Why not?
Because you are not, you did not do your homework.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
And this, you know, treating a woman as a child, as a bad child.
You did not do your homework. There is a record of every word that
such
is
interviews
said.
Interviews will be private and conducted without the need for an oath or transcript.
Now, see, she just says, and conducted without the need for an oath or transcript. She's actually quoting from what the Bush administration is saying. And he goes, no, open transcript.
It's a transcript.
Open transcript.
Or the subsequent issuance of
stop.
So how do we ever find out about what happened?
Stop talking. It's not about you, and you're misleading the audience. Stop talking. Open transcript. In the congressional hearing, there's a transcript.
No, I'm sorry, Bill. There's not, and that's the president's requirement, is that there can't be any form of a transcript whatsoever, period. Your co-host is right.
If they lie in front of Congress, they're prosecuted.
How are we going to know if they lie, Bill?
Leahy will know.
How's he going to know?
Because there's a transcript for Leahy. It's just not a public transcript.
But you just started with saying this doesn't have an effect on we the people. It does have an effect on
doesn't.
We the people.
No, it doesn't.
Yes,
it has nothing
does.
To do with you.
Yeah, and now we're, you know, let's get back to personalizing this and making it angry. It's about you. It's about me and all this, you know, this kind of stuff.
It has nothing to do with your life.
Your local law enforcement officer, the head local law enforcement in your state, it has everything to do with your life.
And no, it doesn't. And now you made a terrible mistake, and you're smarter than that, and you misled my audience, and I'm furious. I am furious at you. There is a transcript available. It's available to the senators in the committee, and that's all they need to charge this guy with lying in front of Congress. And you, Lise Wheel, misled the radio factor
it's
audience.
It's not an open transcript, so we don't find out.
Cut her mic. She's not allowed to speak for 3 minutes.
Yeah. That's a bad girl. Right? But she was right. She was right. I mean, this is kind of a reverse on the old Reagan joke, right?
Yet any time you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goal. They say we're always against things, we're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant, it's just that they know so much that isn't so.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, nice line, but you know, here's the deal. When you ask most men, who are you? They will typically give you an answer that has to do with what they do for a living. You know, I drive a bread truck. I'm a talk show host. I fill in the blank. They won't say, I'm my wife's husband or I'm my son's dad or something like that. Typically, they identify themselves, men typically identify themselves in our society, in our culture, as their job. And so when you threaten their job, as conservatives have been doing for 26 years now, aggressively and arguably going all the way back to 1947 with the passage of Taft-Hartley, which was the first successful attempt by conservatives to destroy the New Deal, to back off from the New Deal. When you threaten their job, they feel insecure. There's a declining standard of living, and the ability to earn a living is eroding, and with that, the sense of, among working class men, of their ability to project themselves into the world, to conquer it in a way that meets the needs of their family. And so what do you see? You see an increase in spousal abuse. You see an increase in child abuse. You see an increase in violence. You see an increase in despair. You see an increase in suicides. In, as I pointed out, the BBC reported, in England, those parts of England that have the highest unemployment rates have the highest suicide rates. Suicide is now even exceeding car deaths, the traditionally the largest killer of men in England. The same thing in Japan. If you look into, for example, the working class prefecture of Okinawa, where jobs have actually been being lost to China, the male suicide rate, this is from the Japanese news service, the male suicide rate per 100,000 people has increased 1.5 times compared to 20 years ago. But the majority of unemployed or underemployed men don't kill themselves. Instead, they get angry and look for a source for their anger. And this is where the conservatives are working hard to perform an elegant smoke and mirrors switch. It's kind of jujitsu, psychological jujitsu. Don't be angry at us. Be angry at them, those women over there. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain, on Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Do you want advice from this administration? I don't think so. We're talking about psychological warfare. Psychological warfare of the first order. This from Limbaugh's Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox right across the board to O'Reilly shutting down the woman working with him on his show. To calling conservatives calling Rosie O'Donnell fat and a witch to Savage going off on that was Glenn Beck to Savage going off on Barbara Walters and calling her a slut and all this whole spectrum of let's beat up on the women because it provides a good role model right for insecure men in this society is a very, very useful tool in the arsenal of psychological warfare that the conservatives are using, and basically, frankly, an ancient tool. Thus, the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, the phallic projection force war in Iraq, the big bulge strut on the aircraft carrier deck, all of this. And frankly, I think that we need to respond in a way that points it out. Arlie Hochschild wrote a great book, a great essay, rather, Let Them Eat War, in which Arlie points out that George W. Bush and Karl Rove have effectively used 9/11 as a substitute for job anxiety and Bush's war in Iraq as a symbolic way for men to vicariously feel personal power via a stand-in, the macho acting guy in the White House, Bush. At the same time, Limbaugh and this entire talk machine, and you just hear all these clips, are doing the best. They're absolutely working overtime to assure the underemployed and threatened men of America that the target of their rage should not be conservative policies. No. In fact, they're framed, if anything, in the abstract. you know, it's just, you know, Roosevelt, he's a bad guy, right?
Roosevelt is dead.
Oh, yeah.
His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
See, occasionally a little bit leaks through. But by and large, no, don't be angry at them. It's those damn liberals who are responsible for the ills that have befallen the working class, particularly this whole idea of, well, the, you know, our guest in the second hour talking about the Supreme Court and how conservatives are working against discrimination by trying to do away with affirmative action for women, for example. So some of the Democratic candidates, you know, in the last election, for example, thought they could out-testosterone Bush. Remember Kerry going out, yeah, I'm going to go out and shoot some geese. And walking around with a gun in his hand and, yeah, I'm going to talk tough on war. You know, instead of trying to out-testosterone the guy, why not talk to the real issues that are driving this? Why not reach out to these literally millions, tens of millions, perhaps, you know, well over 100 million concerned, worried, you know, fundamentally and tragically insecure white male voters who are out there, who are seeing their jobs evaporate, who are seeing their employment go overseas, who are seeing, you know, the factory that they used to work in has been deconstructed and rebuilt in China, or the job that they used to have from being, you know, working in a call center to being an engineer is now being done in India or by an Indian here. And why not reach out to them and say, you know, this bind you find yourself in, this death of the middle class, is not the fault of women in the workplace, because they've been trying to sell that to us for 25 years. Or 40, 50 years ago, what they were trying to sell to insecure, largely white middle class men was that all of their, you know, the big danger to them was African Americans coming into the workplace. Oh, we can't do away with segregation back in the 60s, back in the 50s. You know, can't do away with segregation. You know, Harry Truman integrated the army. That was a very controversial thing. Oh, liberal, pretty soon you're going to have to integrate the American workforce. And then what's going to happen? All these white guys are going to be out of their work, out of their jobs. And now it's women. Right? The best response is to say, no, sorry, it's not. And now it's, and of course now also in addition to women, it's immigrants. Oh, people with brown skin coming across the border from the South. That's the problem. No. The problem is conservative economic policies. The problem is global free trade, free for multinational corporations, screw everybody else trade. The problem is a philosophy that believes that if you just get the numbers right, everything will correct itself. It's all about the numbers. And if everybody lives in fear of everybody else and everybody is always trying to get maximum advantage over everybody else, then that will create a self-correcting system where everybody stands alone as their own island in the world, but all those own islands trying to get their maximum advantage over everybody else, and at the same time being erotically afraid of everybody else, will create a self-correcting system that will maximize freedom and work well for capitalism. And, you know, this is the world of Ayn Rand. This is the world of conservative think tanks. This is the world of game theory. This is the world of von Hayek. It's the world of Milton Friedman of the Chicago School of Economics, and it's the world of insanity, frankly. It doesn't work unless you want the elites to rule the world. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
A little bit of truck, a little bit of hound dog, and a little bit of luck. A little bit of bacon, a little bit of beans, a little bit of you loving up on me. A little bit of how it's supposed to be, a little bit of life, a little bit of backseat.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance! 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. I usually hang out there during the breaks and talk with folks. And, oh my. Keith in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Keith, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, you were talking about the GOP and its war on women.
Yeah. Well, actually, what I'm suggesting is that the war on women is sort of a proxy for the, actually their war on working class men, by and large, or working class
right.
people. And they're
right.
and they're saying to these justifiably concerned and insecure working class men, instead of being pissed off at the conservative industrialists, you should be angry at women or minorities or immigrants.
Well. My point is, one, that I think Mitt Romney, once the evangelical world discovers his own personal views, they're going to embrace him.
What are those views, Keith?
Abortion is a sin. And these views come from the church he belongs to. He's a Mormon. In the Mormon church, women are not allowed to hold a priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line.
Yeah.
And,
well, true in the Catholic Church as well. I mean, I said that's true in the Catholic Church as well, and it's true in Islam as well.
But I think there's a difference that the Mormon theology believes that if you do all the right things on this earth,
mm-hmm.
at some point in the hereafter, you become God of your own earth. And there's no mention of women. I don't know if a woman is like Mrs. Santa Claus or not, but there's no mention of women. But it's also interesting.
Are you a Mormon, Keith?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm inactive, but I was raised in a Mormon community.
Okay.
And left the church when the church had the same... did not let black men hold a priesthood. And then the president...
Well, the position of the church for over 100 years was that that was the mark of Cain, wasn't it?
I was taught that there was a war in heaven with backers for Jesus who wanted free will for men and backers for Satan. And blacks sit on the fence, and that's why they were given the mark of Cain. But that was... It was, and then the church president said, well, all of those blacks are now gone, so they can hold the priesthood, even if they have black skin.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So they recalibrated the theology to meet the times. Keith, I don't know what's going to happen with Mitt Romney and whether or not his Mormonism is going to become an issue. I guarantee you that you can find... as many strange things in Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Muslim theology as you can find in Mormonism. It's, you know, all you have to do is go looking. I mean, go back and read the book of Joshua if you really want your ears to curl or your hair to curl. But it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric.
Tom. I'm glad you... It's good to talk to you again, by the way. Love your work.
Thank you.
I'm glad you brought up the thing of the attacks on women. It's attacks on women and men who are not afraid of women. If you look at Glenn Beck and Tucker Carlson and Rush Limbaugh and the guy Savage, you can see, you can look at them. If anybody, you know anything about people, they're just overgrown little boys who are still afraid of girls. You know, and I was telling you, Screener, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it the same type of losers back during in the 60s during women's rights movement? Didn't they come up with the term pinko? Wasn't the term pinko? That's the term that
you call me pinko.
Right, right.
As if to describe effeminate.
Yeah, men who are afraid of women and intimidated by women in positions of authority, typically held by men, they refer to men who are not afraid of women as pinkos. You know, it's very complex, but you just have to, it's very obvious. I think we would end this very quickly if you simply point that out. They're afraid of women.
Yeah, it's I don't disagree with you, Eric. And you look, it's interesting, you look at the Republican presidential candidates and, you know, multiple marriages, Newt Gingrich delivered his divorce papers to his wife as she was recovering from cancer therapy. Had married his high school math teacher to begin with. I mean, there's some
They have these people have some serious issues. I mean, the other thing, they also, you know, subconscious, it's very complex. They hate men who are not intimidated by women because typically those type of men have less trouble communicating with women. Men who are not intimidated by, but
and
anyway,
then therefore maybe they're even gay.
if they could talk to women. A lot of it is compensating for their own inadequacy.
No, my point is that they think that when they see a normal guy who can have a a relationship and conversation with a woman, they say,
this
guy must be gay. Yeah, exactly. Eric, good point. Whoop, I'm sorry, I hit the button there a little prematurely, but thank you for the call, Eric. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to comment on Tucker Carlson and his comments about Hillary being castrated and overbearing. I mean, didn't Ann Coulter castrate him more than Hillary ever has? You know, I think she called him gay one time, and, he didn't have any problem with that. And, I mean, like, the guy is...
Hit me again, Ann, please!
Yeah. He's pretty effeminate. He's from Frisco, and he wears, the nice clothes and the whole nine yards. I mean,
but he's a conservative, and he's pointing out that Rosie O'Donnell that was Glenn Beck who called her a fat witch, or was that Tucker? I'd have to go back to my sound clips. I think that was Glenn Beck.
Yeah, I mean, but they're all pretty much off the same experience. But I was trying to find something about Tucker's wife online. I couldn't find it because I wanted to see if his wife was overbearing, but.
My understanding is that Tucker has a very normal family life and kids, and they've been married for a long time, and I don't think any of us would be justified in taking pot shots at him at a personal level. And frankly, I'm very uncomfortable with taking pot shots at any of these guys on a personal level. Even though I just took a shot at Newt, he used to be my congressman when I lived in Atlanta, and that was during that time, so it was something that was very close to all of us. But nonetheless, I think that we need to look at this in a larger view rather than, saying this guy or that guy, is he or isn't he or whatever. That's just playing the reverse of the game that they're playing, which is who's going to be bad this week, who's going to be the scapegoat. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bernice.
Hi, Tom. Things you've spoken about this week have really reminded me of a technique that's been so prevalent throughout history. About 45 years ago as a child in Catholic school, we read a book that really impacted me powerfully, and it was Diary of Anne Frank. One of the main points that the nun pointed out to us, believe it or not, was that I found so fascinating and I've kind of watched through the years, is the technique of scapegoating. And it's a term I haven't heard much about lately, but it's exactly, I think, what you're talking about. And these neocons have mastered this in this century. So this war on working class people and, having men be emasculated by women and immigrants are the cause of everything, or poor people in New Orleans caused, this degradation.
Caused the hurricane.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, this is what they're doing. They're scapegoating again.
Yeah. No, and you're absolutely right, Bernice.
It's very sad, but that's where it's at.
Yeah, no, well said. Thank you very much. Mark in Laramie, New Mexico?
Lamy, New Mexico.
I'm sorry.
I just had one observation and a question for you. My observation is that I think America has always had a problem with the feminine. I mean, if you look at what the press did to, like, Jean Harlow, Marilyn Monroe, finally J. Edgar Hoover had her assassinated because she was...
Look at John Adams' wife Abigail's letter to him when he was at the Constitutional Convention, and she sent him a letter saying, don't forget the ladies. And he sent her back, or we shall... create our own little revolution. I forget the exact words, but they were to that effect. And he sent her back a letter saying that the men would not surrender their prerogatives. I mean, that was 1787. This has been around for a long time in this country.
Ever since, we've had a problem. And I might point out that the only two American coins that were ever recalled had women on them, Susan B. Anthony dollar and the Sacagawea dollar. They were perfectly serviceable coins, but they had women. So I agree with you totally about how they're scapegoated, but I have a question for you, and that is, do you think it's a coincidence that the Russians pulled all of their technicians out of Iran this week just before the British soldiers got nabbed?
Well, it might be. I'm a little confused about that, Mark, because the report that I read, and this was CNN or an AP report, I forget which, but in fact it was in my stack to go over on Monday. I don't recall if I talked about it on the air or not. I think I did. Yeah, it started out by saying that the Russians were in a dispute and they were pulling out their technicians, and then it went on to say that the Iranians denied that and said the Russians hadn't left, you know, no technicians had left and there was no dispute, and that the Russians denied it, and they said that they had simply removed about 6% of their personnel because they were, you know, every 6 months people recycle and they've got 6% going back in, and that everything is fine, thank you very much. And the only source of the Russians are and the Iranians are in conflict was the administration, the Bush administration, feeding that information to the American media. And so I'm not sure that the Russians actually pulled out. I mean, if they did, then, yeah, it becomes a 2+2. Uh-oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
If they didn't, then it becomes, you know, the Bushies are stirring the pot, trying to cause problems between the Russians and the Iranians, which also makes perfect sense. Mark, thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A special thanks to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Julian Sukman and Lauren Kirshner at Air America in New York. To Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org. To Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. And to my parents, who gave me birth into this world. And this is my father's favorite song. We played it at his funeral last summer. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, coming up on it in a few seconds, here on the Tom Hartman Program. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, one of the who was it in there? Somebody that takes a Mary Sushi. No, it wasn't Mary Sushi. Sushi Mom. No, that wasn't it here. Yeah, Sushi Mom. Hey Tom, have you called us the smartest minds on the internet lately? Yes, you are. Thank you for hanging out with us. I was talking with the folks in the chat room during the break. Ellen in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey Ellen, what's up?
Hi, welcome to L.A. We love you. I don't think it's an accident that the only people the Bush administration have gone after are women, starting with Bunnettine Greenhouse, the woman at the CIA who was fired for associating with the journalist, Valerie Plame. I mean, there's a whole list of women that they have gone after.
Good point.
I made a list last year, and I don't have it available, but I think that your thoughts are, you know, spot on.
Yeah,
you know?
there's some serious scapegoating going on here, and a good chunk of it is don't look behind the curtain. You know, don't watch the right hand while the left hand is doing something else. While the left hand is ripping you off with international global free trade and all these, you know, deals and agreements and changing the nature, doing away with labor laws and making the Department of Labor hostile to labor instead of in favor, and all these other things that are destroying the American middle class. With the right hand, they're saying, oh, look at it, over here. Here's the villains. It's women.
Right.
It's immigrants. It's
accomplished
Muslims.
Women. Accomplished
yes.
women.
Yeah. Yeah. In particular. Good point,
Thank
Ellen.
You.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Amber in Monterey, California on KRXA. Hey, Amber, what's up?
Thank you for, apropos of what you're talking about, let's go back in history when Bush 41 debated Geraldine Ferraro, was kind of famous, and he was quoted afterwards as saying, well, I guess we kicked a little ass, which is sort of like an anti-feminist term. And you know that.
Although he did say the same thing about Saddam Hussein. In fact, a friend of mine, Horst von Heyer, he was a German. He is a German. He's in his 70s now. He was the guy who went with me the first time I went into Uganda. He went into Colombia with me, and we've been in a few war zones. And we both worked for the same international relief agency. He was in northern Iraq back during the no-fly zone period. and trying to help, trying to get aid into the Kurds, and because they were sealed off, and we were essentially smuggling, you know, medicine into the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. And Bush, George Bush Sr., came out and said, I guess we kicked a little Baghdad butt. That was his public statement.
Yeah.
The next day, in response to that, the next day, Saddam sent a whole bunch of, because he couldn't fly, he sent a whole bunch of people up into the Kurdish region. Horst's car got hit with 36 machine, you know, bullets, AK-47 bullets. He took three of them in his body. A friend of mine who was working with him, Gerhard Liefert, flew down from Germany down to the border, down to the Turkish border. The Americans wouldn't let him cross the border into northern Iraq because it would look bad. And he's like, hey, you know, we've got a German citizen down here bleeding to death. And no, you can't do that. So he had to go 100 miles down the border and find a guy he could bribe to get in. He brings Horst to the border, and at that point, you know, they're like, okay, we've got this, you know, guy who's bleeding, you know. And I flew over there, and I met them in Frankfurt and then, you know, back to the hospital in Kulmbach. And this was all about, and none of it was allowed to be in the press. I mean, the fact that Saddam, in defiance of Bush Sr., was killing people in the north. I mean, just aggressively killing people in the north. And you know, I mean, we were there, and one of my friends was in the middle of it. And none of it made it into the press because it would have made George Bush Sr. look like he had not been successful in kicking a little Baghdad butt. So he was fond of that phrase.
Well, I think at the time, though, it was a very anti-feminist statement because she was the first woman to be on a major ticket.
And yeah, well,
it was interpreted that way at the time. And, of course, I just have a feeling that that sentiment permeates the whole Bush dynasty through today. And, you know, and as you say, the anti-feminist, anti-female, and I distinguish female from feminist because not all females ascribe to the, you know, to any straight line of feminism. But I think that, you know, that sentiment permeates their thinking, that we're just got to turn the clock back and that we trivialize anything that women do, we have to maintain our macho stance and so on. So that's basically the way I picked it up. And of course, there, you know, there's all ramifications based also from what you say. But you know, you make sense, and I agree with you that there's a strong female anti-female bias running through this administration.
Yeah, thank you very much, Amber. Robert in Hollywood, we have a little less than a minute to wrap up the show here.
Okay, I'll do it in less than that. How you doing, Mr. Hartman? Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I do agree with your premise about the issue of sexism plagiarizing the society, especially the Bush administration. But I think when I listen to those talk show hosts, those neocon talk show hosts with those comments, I think it had less to do with the overall premise of the argument and more to do with the fact that you're dealing with some people who just have a lot of emotional issue. They're delusional, and they cannot in any way, shape, or form have a civilized, respectful debate, you know?
They're not angry.
Yeah, well, they really seem crazy, you know? They need, you know, I don't know. It's a situation where they just, you know, O'Reilly with his comment is just crazy.
Yeah. Maybe, Robert, as good liberals, we should offer them free therapy. I don't know. Thank you for the call, though. I appreciate it. And sorry to hit you there with Bill O'Reilly yelling shut up at you. It's probably bad manners. Coming up Monday on the next Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio, I'll be shaking it up with conservative Robert Peters from Morality in the Media about the implications of a federal judge recently striking down the internet porn law. And as always, the best of the rest of the news, that and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, the radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. See you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom.